The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, it's nice to have you back in the studio today. Now, of course, we're recording this on Election Day, so we really can't talk about the outcome either way. You know, with that said, Dave, we're not the only election or the only regime change possibly coming. That probably one of the bigger issues is not a four-year term here in America, but a 10-year period of time that's coming up for China.
Well, exactly. And so we record Tuesday for Wednesdays, and by the time this airs, we'll know which of the two most popular personalities will be in the White House. And I think really what we have to consider is the policies that they have to implement going forward.
Yeah.
Regardless of which party is in power, the policies that determine the future course for us fiscally is absolutely paramount. And as you said, we do have other political changes around the world that are incredibly important and actually have direct bearing to the U.S. Treasury market and U.S. dollar stability.
Well, and those are coming up in the next week.
Exactly. November 8th is the beginning of the handover. Congress begins meeting on the 8th, and President Hu Jintao is due to hand over the Communist Party leadership to Vice President Xi Jinping. And again, that begins November 8th. The real question is, the implementation of this five-year plan and the transition after that to the next five-year plan, these two together are what the new leadership will be putting into place.
Well, and actually, Dave, it's worth talking about this today because you're right. We don't know the outcome of the election today while we're talking here in America. But our largest creditor is China. And the five-year plans that have come out, there have been numerous five-year plans. The latest one just kicked in the beginning of this year. But you do have leadership change coming, and you've got different opinions worldwide as to whether that's going to be positive or negative for the world economy.
There's this thing called the middle income trap that many countries in the process of development slip into, and it basically is a higher plateau. Incomes reach a level that they just can't seem to get beyond. So improvement, 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 and then a stall. And that's really the concern in China. The transition that they're trying to put in place would take them from that middle income trap potential into a long-term sustainable growth path of 3 to 4% GDP growth. Per year. I think what we see is an effort being made. We don't know if they'll be successful, but we do have this five-year plan, which has been explored thoroughly by the World Bank, 300 pages of exploration of how they can be successful in implementing this five-year plan and some of the policy constraints that they need to encounter and resolve, you know, with this new leadership.
Well, and David, we have to realize here in America, the two things that are definitely affected and affect our pocketbooks are the way China buys our bonds, and that affects the interest rates as well as commodities. If there's a change in the growth pattern in China, there's a change in the value of the dollar, in the value of our ability to get loans.
And this was certainly one of our primary topics in this year's DVD, as the Chinese maintain a dual orientation to both external growth, that is exports as a major input to their economy, and investment. And in investment, what we mean by that is building out infrastructure, bridges, roads, railroads, you know, things that will allow them to grow in the future. But that investment is very intensely natural resource dependent. And so, of course, over the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years, we've seen a massive increase in demand for your basic commodities.
Well, like copper and steel and those types of things. If there was a slowdown, we would definitely see a change in the price on those commodities.
With many of those commodities being consumed, 50% of global demand being consumed by China alone, yeah, a change in orientation has a dramatic impact. I mean, why is this important for us, and why are we talking about it, particularly now in sort of our own election cycle? Because frankly, we have some major decisions to make, whether it's the U.S. fiscal cliff or our annual deficit, let alone our long-term liabilities, that have to be addressed in the next administration. And it's happening at a time that is very inconvenient. Inconvenient because you've got the Chinese, our primary creditor, who may not be stepping up to finance our deficits the way they have in years past, as they focus more internally on their own transition. So the question for us in terms of Chinese leadership is a compelling question. Will they be more hardline? Will they move back towards an even greater internal focus? And with diminished trade reserves, and we're talking about, again, trade surplus dollars, which have come from the United States and our penchant to overconsume, will they be recycling into U.S. treasuries and support our budget deficit as they have in years past?
Well, and David, we've talked about interest rates being artificially held low. Well, one of the reasons we can do that is because we have people who are still buying our debt. You know, something that's been fascinating with what's gone on in Europe, a lot of people were seeing the euro as a transitionary change replacement currency for the dollar. Yet what we're seeing in Europe right now is actually adding strength to the dollar. So, David, we've seen dollar strength because of the change in the euro, okay, the difference in the value of the euro. But you've got other currencies out there, and when people start to get worried about risk in any economy, they still seem to run to the dollar. Even though we may be long-term dollar bears, the dollar still seems to be a place where flight capital runs.
Let's talk about zero interest rate policies, because what the Fed has done by setting interest rates so low is it created a context in which we are a funding currency. Mm-hmm. In other words, in terms of international carry trade dynamics, individual investors and institutions will borrow in U.S. dollar terms because of the very low interest rates that they have to pay back,
right,
and then take that borrowed money and invest it in countries where sovereign paper is paying more. So literally, if I can borrow for less than 1% and invest in a country that's paying over 3% and pocket the difference, I'm using someone else's money to make a fortune.
Well, Dave, that was the game here in America 10 years ago called the carry trade with Japan. We'd borrow it at virtually nothing.
In Japanese yen.
Yeah, and just buy treasuries.
Now, the issue is you end up having to unwind that trade to some degree as the dollar appreciates, because you've got to pay back those dollars
with more expensive dollars.
With more expensive dollars. And if there is a change in interest rate dynamics, of course, that exacerbates the issue as well. So downward pressure in the foreign currency markets and upward pressure for any reason in the dollar market, again, that's not necessarily gold negative.
Right.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that in the short run, we could see dollar strength, and that's not necessarily gold negative, because I think one of the things you have to figure on the other side of the equation is dollar strength equals foreign currency weakness. And to the degree that we have foreign currency weakness, you have gold strength in those other foreign currency terms.
Well, like this week, didn't we hit in the last couple of weeks a new high versus the euro, gold to the euro?
Exactly. If you price gold in euro terms, it's just been within the last few weeks that we've hit all-time highs.
Yeah.
So this is the dynamic. No one in the United States likes to see the price of gold go lower in U.S. dollar terms. And yet, it's not going lower in global currency terms. And frankly, the more important audience today, it's not a U.S. audience. It is an international audience with a greater penchant for owning gold than your average U.S. investor, or certainly U.S. central bank. So you have foreign central banks and foreign investors who see their currencies depreciating, frankly, in lockstep with the dollar, but just it depends on a day or a given week which is depreciating more, they are compelled to own gold. And I think that's important to note, because it is not necessarily the case that the dollar goes higher and gold must go lower.
Right.
Because, in fact, it did not happen that way in the 1970s. Yet we saw a dollar decline through 73, 74, 75. By about 76, it started to taper off. Five central banks came in, intervened in the currency markets. The dollar stabilized, and from 78 forward, guess what?
They both went up, didn't they? Gold and the dollar.
You actually saw the dollar begin to rebound. Gold's going up, and the dollar's going up. And many people were confused, because they thought that the gold price and the trajectory of the gold price was dependent on dollar weakness, which
right.
is not the case. It's not the case. Particularly in an environment like this, where demand for the physical metal is not U.S. or dollar centric,
right.
but it relates to other currencies and other places around the world. They have far outpaced demand versus what we've seen here in the United States.
Well, and you know, talking about other currencies, I want to shift back to China here for a second, because you know, their economy in a world perspective is less than 20% of the world economy, but the money that they've created, it's about half right now of all new monetary growth is coming straight out of China.
You're talking about broad measures of money supply, and yes, since 2007, they've accounted for between 40 and 50% of all growth across the 16 largest economies of the world. And this is an expansion from $5.47 trillion back in 2007
right.
to where their broad money is today, $14.49 trillion.
Now, you're converting renminbi to dollars, just to give an idea of the scope of the
exactly.
thing. That's almost what our deficit is.
Well, and the concern is, of course, that with such a rapid expansion comes major increases in non-performing loans
right.
and major problems in the banking system. Again, it's just important to reiterate that the bull market dynamics in the gold market, we tend to fixate on a very U.S.-centric view of gold, which has been and will continue to be frankly irrelevant, except in the case of the U.S. bond and dollar markets moving into the limelight. And then I think over the next 3, 4, and 5 years, then you can begin to see demand dynamics here in the United States pick up as we deal with our own issues domestically.
So what you're going to have is an awful lot of money chasing a certain amount of items, like coming from China, all right? We know that the Chinese are buying more gold than anybody right now. The Chinese and the Indians are overwhelming the gold market. But there's also a tremendous amount of flight capital coming out of China and going into other countries, and there's mechanisms that these guys are using to try to get away with it.
One would think that given the massive amount of flight capital from China, that insiders are anticipating either a radical shift in economic engineering, again, away from their interests. And these, are, again, are your corporate insiders, your government insiders, who have, through graft and theft and corruption, been able to carve out as much as 17% of Chinese GDP to sort of line their personal pockets. You know, again, we are now at the cusp of a decade-long leadership change. Is that group of very interested and already benefited people looking and saying, this won't be good for me, this won't be good for my pocketbooks? What if we end up with a group of hardliners coming in and radically alter that system of vested interests? Maybe even they address the pervasive corruption in the Chinese economy. This is, I think, stunning, frankly. The Reuters article out last week, Kevin, that detailed the smuggling of funds out of China. You know, we've looked at Treasury reports going back to 2010, and have been surprised to see how large the numbers were.
Right.
What Reuters put together was an estimate of $3.79 trillion being smuggled out of the country over the past decade. Close to $4 trillion being smuggled out. Now, for 2011 alone, $472 billion leaving in 2011, which is extraordinarily high when compared to the foreign direct investment figures. And again, that's your outside investors coming in and building plants and infrastructure in China, thinking that their company will have some benefit from doing so. Foreign direct investment figures going back from 1998 to 2011, cumulative figures of $310 billion. Foreign direct investment of 310 over about a decade's period. 1 year, you're outpaced by capital flight of $472 billion. And again, why is this important? Why are we fixating on it? Because frankly, the insiders in China know that radical change is getting ready to take place. Connect that dot with the change impacting the U.S. because if in fact they are successful in implementing their five-year plan and move towards being more internally consumption-oriented, what that implies is two things. It implies higher currency values, and it implies an increased wages for your average worker there in China. What that means is that they're no longer competitive in terms of an export advantage. They don't want the export advantage. If you are, in fact, being consistent with the five-year plan, as stated, you want to drive internal consumption, and these two benefits get you that much closer to it. The change in game means that the old players have to leave. And they're doing so as we speak.
Which means we have to find new people to loan us money. And, you know, this is, I'm going to go back to China, though, for a second. Here in America, quantitative easing, the printing of money, supposedly translates into higher stock prices. We've seen that. We've seen higher stock valuations here. But Shanghai, if China is creating all this new money, how come the stock exchange is at four-year lows?
Well, I think a lot of the money has gone into real estate and real estate development projects. A lot of the money has gone into wealth management products that have had little to nothing to do with the stock exchange there in Shanghai. And so, yeah, we're sitting at four-year lows. And a rally, frankly, is quite possible, particularly as we move past this power transition and investors kind of know how to adapt and how to adjust. But the reality is large investors are in a wait and see mode as to who will be in the top leadership positions and how they will govern.
Well, even if there's a rally, I mean, Deutsche Bank and other large institutions are waiting and watching because they think maybe the long-term trend is not so great for China.
No, in fact, you've got Deutsche Bank saying basically the underpinnings in China are very negative. On that basis, they're not interested in Russia. They're not interested in Brazil. They're not interested in a number of countries that supply basic materials to China.
Yeah, let's stop and look at that, because that can sometimes be confusing when someone says, well, we're not positive on China's growth, so we're not going to buy something in Brazil. Explain the thinking there, because Brazil, Russia, and those who supply those industrial commodities to China, they're dependent on China.
Well, Australia, I mean, come on, this is, when you start looking at not just 1% of GDP, but 3 and 5 and 10% 10% of GDP, which is moving towards one particular customer. This is what most business owners fear,
right?
Having one customer that represents too much of their business, because if anything changes with that customer relationship, your business is going to hurt. You know, the ability to keep the lights on is not on the basis of losing 50%, but it's usually a much smaller margin that determines whether or not you're in business or not in business.
So just like we need China to borrow money, they need China to buy things.
Well, and the view of Deutsche Bank and a couple of their analysts there is the Chinese growth and the changes that are happening there, the slowdown is structural and not cyclical. And what that basically means is this is a long-term trend change, and this is not a short-term sort of veering from the path in terms of growth. We thought it was going to be double-digit forever and a day. It's no longer going to be double-digit. Now it's 7 to 8% growth rates in China, moving towards a 3 to 4% growth rate. And again, this is a normal expected course, and it assumes that they are, in fact, going to be successful in transitioning to being an internally consumption-oriented economy. As you reiterated again, the grave implications for the U.S. is if they don't have trade surplus dollars to recycle into treasuries, where are we going to get our deficit financing?
Well, and David, you know, this, what's coming up next, this fiscal cliff, reminds me a little bit of Sandy, you know, the hurricane that hit last week in New York, the worst one that they've ever had. And now there's a tropical storm brewing again, possibly an Atlantic storm that's going to come back in. And I'm thinking about, you know, if China does change and our main creditor stops buying, or we have to come up with something else. As we said before, the people who are listening to this commentary today already know who the new president will be, whether he's new or whether he's still the old president. But either one has to face the fiscal cliff.
Well, there's a couple of things that, again, regardless of who wins, it's going to be a tough road to go down. The winner will have to stand by and see if the House and Senate work together to resolve the fiscal cliff and then address head-on the growing problem of deficit spending.
Right.
I mean, this is really, again, when we look at things, it's from as neutral a position as possible. Win, lose, or draw, what are the issues in play for the victor? And policies proposed after the inauguration will even then face implementation risks.
So would you say economically the two things that they're facing, fiscal cliff, budget deficits? Well, let's look at the fiscal cliff just for a moment.
Exactly. Those are the primary considerations for the victor, the fiscal cliff and budget deficit. In, you know, the balancing act, if you wanted to look at what we're spending today versus what our national income is, this is why we have a major problem. We're spending greater than 22.5% of our gross domestic product. We're bringing in the equivalent of 15.7% of our gross domestic product, and that gap is what we define as a deficit. We're spending more than we're bringing in. It's quite simple. The fiscal cliff is the first problem, and if it's left unresolved, the market is likely to sell off. We're talking about the equity market, is likely to sell off considerably. U.S. interest rates rising, again, regardless of Fed manipulation of pricing in the bond market, the free market will overwhelm the Fed. And I guess if you want to draw that distinction, the free market between the Fed market, the Fed market has been driving interest rates lower, not the free market.
Right.
The free market can reassert itself at any point. And this is what they popularly call the bond vigilantes, saying basically, we don't think that this is going to be resolved nicely, and we're going to have to factor in more credit risk and receive more interest for the loans outstanding. In other words, people start liquidating bonds and interest rates go up regardless of Fed activity.
So, David, if they could resolve the issue, we may see low interest rates continue for a while. But if they can't resolve the issue, this should be a big blinking red light for the person who's got a large bond portfolio.
Well, certainly, because, I mean, you're trusting the now AA rating, not the AAA rating, of a U.S. debt. It's already been downgraded by Egan Jones and S&P. The question is, does the lonely voices of those two rating agencies become a chorus, you know, with Moody's and Fitch and others stepping in to say, you're right. You're really right. There's more credit risk here. We don't see the House and Senate working on a real solution here, and we're going to have to factor that risk into the rating of U.S. debt. A downgrade, I think this time around, will equate to considerably higher interest rates.
Okay, but let's go on to the enduring problem. Okay, the problem that just continues on, and there is no administration that's really answered to this, and that is the budget deficit. Okay, the government cannot afford to go into debt for forever, but right now, Dave, they're reporting positive GDP growth of a couple of percent, but in reality, 8 to 10% of that growth is coming from just government deficit spending money.
Yeah, and this is, again, why you describe it as an enduring problem, is because if you look at the decade of the 70s and 80s and 90s, the decades of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we were spending more than we were bringing in. We ran deficits every year from about 72 on, and then for a few brief years in the late 90s and into 2001, 2002, we actually ran a surplus. But it was almost an accident to run a surplus coming at the tail end of a massive bull market, the largest bull market, in fact, in U.S. equity history, mm-hmm. where incomes were off the charts and tax revenues on the basis of exploding incomes were off the charts. So you had income on the rise and spending was actually in decline as we came into the turn of the millennium. Now, why do we have an enduring problem? It's the same problem we had in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Government spends too much money.
Yeah, but back then it was in the billions, now it's in the trillions. And so, you know, David, if we really were accounting the way you have to account as a person who runs a company, if we were actually using accounting standards, is the deficit that we're being told the actual deficit?
Right, because the current deficit of roughly $1 trillion is the equivalent of 8 to 10% of GDP. This is massive Keynesian deficit spending to fill the gap to where the consumer left off. But if you accounted for it as the generally accepted accounting principles instruct you to, as a business owner, as a corporate entity, you must,
right.
then our $1 trillion deficit for fiscal 2012 was actually over a $5 trillion deficit. And that factors in long-term liabilities into current reality.
Well, David, you had talked about the downgrade that we had had from rating agencies on our government debt from AAA down to AA. Now, that has implications that a lot of people don't really realize. There are portfolios out there that have to, by prospectus, hold a certain degree of debt as far as quality of debt. And when the downgrade comes, they have to liquidate that debt.
A forced liquidation.
Yeah. And so what are we looking at for 2013 with these rating agencies?
The fight's going to be to convince the rating agencies that our fiscal house can and will be put in order, and quickly, which carries with it, again, abandoning political intransigence. And this is where, in an election year, we've seen a lot of it. And again, this is not to blame one party or the other. This is on a partisan basis. Everyone's been looking to gain an advantage and perhaps blame the other party for this problem or that. The issue is we can't afford intransigence as we come up to either the fiscal cliff or our budget deficit, because we are now in a testing phase where the rating agencies will be looking at us on a much more detailed basis, if you will. We'll be under the microscope.
Well, and being under the microscope with so much division right now in Washington, David, do you really see the House and the Senate working together on this fiscal cliff?
The real question is whether the resolution is temporary or a permanent solution. And it would not surprise me at all to see them patch together some plan that kicks the can into 2013 or 2014. Mm. That's what we've seen politicians do so effectively, is disavow any responsibility for a problem, make sure that on their watch they can't be blamed, and push the issue into the future, hoping that something, time and the tide of events, perhaps the grace of greater capital flow coming from the Fed, cheap and easy credit, cheap and easy money, will solve the problem. They don't want to do the hard lifting. Right. But can they put something together? I think that's at best what they will do, is sort of a patchwork quilt of something that'll carry them through this end of year crisis and maybe towards the end of 2013 or 2014.
It's like Europe. Nobody wants to feel the pain right now. I mean, well, it's human nature. Nobody really wants to feel the pain, but it's coming.
Well, the first test, as we said, is actually prior to January 1st and the inauguration. The House and Senate are not seen working close together on the fiscal cliff. We're looking at a 2 to 3% drop in GDP heading into 2013. Then downgrades on U.S. debt are sure to follow, along with the potential for an equity market bloodbath. It'll be difficult to avoid the attention of the international media, and this may, in fact, serve as the transition point from media maintaining really a Eurocentric focus. Again, we've been enamored with or gotten a free pass for the last 3 years. Europe's been in the spotlight. We haven't.
Right.
And I think that may be a change, if you will, a transition point where certainly Spain, Portugal, and Greece can reemerge as problems in sort of the beauty contest or the ugly contest, if you will. But we are in the process of throwing our hat in the ring.
So we get to be the ugly duckling for a while?
Very well could be as we head into 2013.
Well, David, the jobs report that came out last Friday was supposedly very, very exciting, very positive. It almost looked like it was a ploy to, you know, put in by the Democrats. But the markets didn't take it that way, did they?
No, they didn't, because it actually was not that positive. And it was, it's fascinating listening again to the political pundits coming into the election. You know, everything's dependent on interpretation.
Yeah.
And I think the interpretive lens that was put over the jobs report, at least on the Obama side, was that it was very positive. 171 was a great number. It beat any of the estimates that were out there. Meanwhile, the number U3 jumped from 7.8 to 7.9. I think the story is always in the details. The devil's always in the details. And the fact that 90,000 of those jobs were fabricated statistically through the birth-death models, to me, says everything. 171 was fiction to begin with, and I don't know why we even bring it up.
But the better part of half of that was fabricated.
Well, exactly. But I think the bigger issue, again, whoever wins or loses, the market is trying to figure out what the implications are. And Friday was very revealing in terms of what they think will be the victory story. Friday, on the basis of the jobs report, would have put Romney as a winner. Everything was down except for the dollar, because it represents the end of QE, easy money around the corner. If Romney does get elected, then there's going to be a change in leadership at the Fed, and what the market has grown dangerously dependent on,
right,
cheap money, could go away. And that hit all of your quote-unquote risk-on assets.
Okay, David, we still don't know who the winner's going to be, so let's go ahead and go with the Obama side. Let's say Obama wins. What happens to equities?
The opposite stands to reason with an Obama re-election. Dollar weakness, more easy money, and a prop to your risk-on trades. But it is interesting, even in this context, Kevin, where we've had the most heavily owned equities coming under tremendous pressure, Apple and Google. And then if you look at sort of a sampling of the most heavily owned equities by hedge funds, you know, supposed to be the sophisticated group and the most sophisticated investment group on the planet, Apple, Google, Microsoft, JP Morgan, Qualcomm, Citigroup, these are your top investments, and they're all tech and finance. Tech and finance, throw in some telecom. This is fascinating to me because we're actually seeing a breaking down of the leadership. I mean, again, these are the most heavily owned stocks, not only by hedge funds, but by 401ks and the general investment public. And now Apple's 17% off its peak. Google is cracking as well. What does this pretend? Well, let me go back into the archives, because I used to pay attention to the chief economists at Morgan Stanley when I worked at Morgan Stanley, and I like to see how the company paraded out their chief economists on occasion to make a point and to prove a point. What I'm recalling, Kevin, is sort of the 2001 period where equities had been in decline, and Morgan Stanley drew out all of their economists onto the stage and said, we have consensus. We never have consensus. Everyone thinks that the stock market is going higher.
Well, David, except for one economist who we've spoken to a number of times on this commentary.
And as you looked at the chairs on the stage, there was one chair missing. It wasn't that it was empty, but your four chief economists became three for the consensus to be made. And the consensus was, we're moving higher. Stephen Roach was absent. They did not include his voice in the picture.
And look who was right.
But one of the perma bulls, and he's always been a perma bull, is Byron Wien. Hmm. Byron Wien, Barton Biggs, these are the guys who in that day were the perpetual bulls of Morgan Stanley. Stanley, always calling for higher prices in equities because it served, frankly, their corporate clients' interests to do so. The perpetual bull, Byron Wien, today has five reasons why he's concerned about 2013. And again, this is just fascinating commentary to me, because for perpetual bull to look at 2013 and say, I don't care who wins, I think we've got problems immediately in front of us, that registers for me.
Sure.
It registers,
well,
again,
you've been
because
following it so long.
Well, I know that, like a broken record, he's always bullish. I don't have to read anything that he says, because I know exactly what he's going to say, except when I read something and it doesn't sound like a broken record.
It got
that
your attention.
That gets my attention.
Yeah.
Well, just to look at some of the points, I mean, clearly he sees the decline in profits for the Standard & Poor's 500. Everyone's expecting greater than $100 per share, and he thinks it might actually disappoint. Now, basically what that means is the profit margins are peaking. Your companies who have had a good year in 2012, he's arguing, cannot do a repeat performance in 2013, or certainly will not be putting in even better numbers in 2013. Also very concerned with the fiscal cliff and a potential slice 3% out of GDP. And again, they are assuming, as they look at a slice out of GDP, they're assuming much understated inflation numbers. We've said this before, but if you understate inflation, you end up overstating GDP to begin with. So the GDP figure for us is almost an irrelevant number. We would look at the income of the average consumer. Is their income increasing? If their income is increasing, then the economy is going to be growing. GDP ends up being a manipulated number because you can manipulate the inflation statistic, which ends up overstating GDP to begin with.
But David, income is falling. We know that. And we know that we're borrowing too much money. So deficits, I think that was one of his issues as well.
Well, of course, the annual U.S. deficit, without both cutting expenditures, which now represent close to 24% of GDP, and raising taxes, which is close to 17% of GDP, there is a crisis, and Washington has to do something. Then the last point that he makes, and we haven't included everything here, but the last point that he makes is the potential for Israel and a first strike in Iran. Like we saw with Osirik many, many years ago, not on a permission-granted basis, but just because they recognize an existential threat, what does that do? Brent crude soaring to $150 to $200 a barrel, the Strait of Hormuz being closed temporarily, and that exacerbating problems in terms of recessionary trends both in Europe and the United States. When I see someone who's perpetually bullish, always thinks that it's going to be better tomorrow, and they're not, it does give me pause.
Well, and David, you know, just to remind the listener, you've already produced two DVDs this year, the third of this three-part series you've been waiting on for this election result. And so over the next few weeks, you will be doing analysis and giving a very clear direction as to what we see is coming with whoever's president and whatever regime changes there are worldwide.
That's right. The last installment of this year's film series is a post-election synthesis. We've looked at Europe, we've looked at Asia, China in particular, and the last one will be the implications into the equity, bond, and dollar markets over the next 3 to 4 years, 2014 and 2015 being particularly critical. As a result of this election and the potential policies that are implemented over the next 4 years.
So our listeners should be listening to this program to find out when they can see that next installment of the video.
Probably coming out around January 1.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.